This is Research Spotlight at Cumbria.
I guess it's then you really discover what areas of your broader field are those that interest you the most. And it was the animal behaviour side that really, I mean, I'm interested in ecology and evolution, but behaviour is really my number one passion.
In this podcast series, we're profiling our researchers, hearing in detail about their work and the impact this has on wider society.
Cultures do exist, things like chimpanzees, bonobos, humpback whales, dolphins, and other species as well. If animals do have these cultures and they're reliant on them in order to survive in their environment, it follows that we also need to pay attention to whether we're preserving that cultural knowledge as well as all that genetic information. I'm Dr. Will Hoppett, and I'm a lecturer in zoology. I was previously in academia, most recently at Leeds University, but for a few years I'd actually been working as a statistical consultant, mostly helping out other researchers with their statistical analyses. They'd pay me to do those for them usually, which was a very rewarding time, but I wanted to come back into academia. The job came up at Cumbria, and I knew one of my former colleagues who was a postdoc with me at St Andrews University, Volker Diek. I knew he was here, and I knew he was being very successful here. So I got in touch and he told me a lot about how it's a new university and how there's the opportunity to have a larger impact and be a lot more relevant than one would be in a bigger institution like my previous institution, like Leeds. And that sounded good to me. I wanted to be part of something new. And so I applied and I was lucky enough to get the post. I think there's just so many nice wild areas, by UK standards at least, they're wild. You could go in any direction from Carlisle, where I'm based, and into some nice countryside, which just personally for me is very nice, but also very good for an institution running zoology course, because you can go to so many places on field trips, give the students some really valuable learning experiences out in the field.
So go on and take us back to what got your interest in this area of study years ago. What kind of very specialised area of zoology?
First of all, I suppose what got me interested in zoology in the first place was when I was very young, going on holiday with my family to the Alps, looking for golden eagles. That got me interested in birds. And from there, I became interested in zoology more broadly. So even before I chose my GCSEs, I knew I wanted to do zoology at university. And so my GCSEs and A-levels were all picked with that in mind. My interest in animal behaviour, and more specifically in animal social learning, that came about during my undergraduate years. I guess it's then you really discover what areas of your broader field are those that interest you the most. And it was the animal behaviour side that really, I mean, I'm interested in ecology and evolution, but behaviour is really my number one passion. And there I learnt about current research into social learning as well, which at the time was mostly a lot of laboratory-based experiments to try and figure out, can animals imitate one another as we humans can? And I was fascinated by this and I wanted to get involved. So that led me to apply to a PhD in that specific field with Kevin Lala, or Lala it's called now. Initially that was at Cambridge and then moved up to St Andrews with him, and my career went on from there.
Wow, and is there much known about animal behaviours? Is it an area that's still ripe for research?
Yes, I think so. I think it was first made famous by the ethologists who actually won the Nobel Prize on this, like Tim Bergen, von Trisch and Lorenz. And they took an approach to animal behaviour that's called ethology, which is focusing on studying animals in their natural environment and understanding not only the mechanisms of behaviour, but also how their behaviour is adapted by evolution to allow them to survive in their environment. And this differed quite a bit from the previous approach, which would have been that of the comparative psychologists. So mainly interested in those days in looking at model organisms like pigeons and rats and using them as a model for human behaviour. So that's how ethology differed from psychology. I think psychological and biological approaches to animal behaviour have merged more in recent times. So there's a lot of people studying animal cognition who are interested in how animals process the information and act on the information that they receive. And they will be often have backgrounds in psychology or backgrounds in zoology, or they'll be integrating the two things in those kinds of studies. Another key area of animal behaviour at the moment is called behavioural ecology. And that's more focused on specifically how animal behaviour is adapted by evolution, by natural selection, to allow animals to survive in their natural habitats. And all of these fields are, of course, evolving the whole time.
You mentioned your colleague Volker Diek before for an earlier podcast for this university, yes. University of Cumbria. His work in Wales, absolutely fascinating. You know, the distances to travel, but also yes, the fact that he's actually known, I think, you know, from birth, a calf, which has now grown in the time that he's been studying Wales. This relationship he's had, I think, has been absolutely fascinating. He's able to track and see how they're doing. You know, they have their own family. Again, that was a whole new area that I imagine many people don't even consider.
Yes, I think my own research fits into that very much within that remit. I mean, you've brought up cetaceans there. I think they studying animal behaviour in their natural environment can often be more difficult in a way than in a laboratory setting where you have very close control over what experiences the animal has. So in my case, I'm often interested in inferring whether animals are learning to do things, learning novel skills, for example, by learning from others. And in a laboratory setting, that's, shall I say, relatively easy because you can control whether an animal has a certain type of social experience and look at what effect that has on its learning. If you're looking at animals that are moving around freely in their environment, you don't have a complete record of what they're seeing and what they're doing. And a lot of my research is trying to find ways around that and so we can still make these scientific inferences about whether they're learning from one another. It's interesting you bring up cetaceans because we have been able to make, myself and collaborators have been able to make some good steps in studying cetaceans. One example is some colleagues and collaborators of mine and I, we looked at the spread of a novel behavior through a group of humpback whales. If I explain what the behavior is first, I think everyone's probably seen what's called a lob tail. This is where the humpback puts his tail right out of the water and slaps it down on the surface of the waves. Everyone's probably seen that on David Attenborough documentaries and the like. Another thing humpback whales do is they do something called bubble netting, where if they find a shoal of fish, they will kind of try and surround it with a net of bubbles and then come up lunging through the middle of that net of bubbles to consume the fish trapped within it. Lobtail feeding was something a little bit different. They actually did the lobtail and then did the bubble netting. So that's what we called lobtail feeding. And this combination of those two behaviours is what we were interested in. We're not quite sure why they did it. It could be that the lobtail startled the fish into a tighter shoal that could be more easily entrapped. That wasn't really the focus of our study. The focus of our study is, are they learning to do this from one another? Because it appeared that way. The behaviour spread through this population. But there are alternative explanations. It could be that a new prey type had recently appeared in the area that was easier to catch using this lobtail feeding technique. And if that were the case, it could be that each individual whale was learning, as we'd say, asocially, the appropriate technique for hunting this new prey type. These are all the kinds of alternative explanations we have to rule out. Or we have to find some kind of signature of in the pattern of spread that suggests it is social learning. And that's the second approach we took there. And the logic there was, if the order in which whales learnt this novel feeding technique followed the social network, the pattern of who tends to hang out with whom, then that suggests they're learning from one another. We applied a technique I've worked on called network-based diffusion analysis, and we used that to show that it's actually extremely likely that the whales were learning this behaviour from one another.
In terms of the research that you've done so far, then where's this leading to? Is it part of a wider network, perhaps across the world, of research that's been done by people like yourself?
Yes, I think so. I think, well, my main contribution to the field is, so far, is my development of these statistical techniques for detecting social learning and for studying social learning in these freely interacting groups, but also collaborating with researchers to apply those techniques. So apart from cetaceans like the humpback whale I mentioned and the bottlenose dolphins that a former PhD student was studying, I've also been involved in projects on a number of primates like various monkeys, chimpanzees and bonobos, some projects on fish like guppies and sticklebacks, insects, honeybees and birds. What have we got there? We've got zebra finches and budgies I've worked on in the past. So a nice, I should say, a former undergraduate project student of mine did a project on captive otters, and she actually published her research in a journal, in a top journal, I should say. So quite a range of species.
Very much, yeah, and cutting-edge research, which clearly matters. Just as in why it does matter, I mean, clearly all research is interesting and it's curious, but why do you think this matters in your area in particular?
Well, I think the initial interest in studying social learning in freely interacting populations rather than in animals in laboratory situations was what we've called the animal cultures debate. So this is something that's more of academic interest, but also of interest to those who I think just love learning about animals and how they survive in their environment. So the idea was that species like chimpanzees actually have something like the culture that humans have. So Andy Whiten at St Andrews led a team of researchers showing that chimpanzees in different areas have different behaviour patterns to survive in their environment. In some places, they will use a technique called ant dipping to get ants out of their nests and consume those. In other places, they'll use termite fishing. And there are a whole load of different behaviour patterns that the chimpanzees will use, and they differ in different places. And in some cases, they'll even have different behaviours to accomplish the same function in different places. So the idea is that different innovations have arisen in each chimpanzee population, and they've spread through each population by social learning, resulting in different cultures in different populations. So critics of this highly influential study, myself included, said there are alternative explanations. It could be that the local ecology for these different populations is different, and so they're each learning individually to adapt to that local environment, and that leads each population to act in the same way as others in that population, but in a different way to other populations. Alternatively, there might be some genetic differences among the different groups of chimpanzees, causing them to act in genetically predisposing them to behave in different ways. And to be fair, you know, Whiten and his colleagues did make efforts to rule these out, but then the debate was, had they done so successfully? And it was this debate that really led to the call for new methods to try and figure out how important social learning is in freely interacting natural animal populations. I think the work I've been involved with has added quite a bit to the evidence that cultures do exist, things like chimpanzees, bonobos, humpback whales, dolphins, and other species as well. So that's the historic angle on where my research fits in. However, going forwards, people have started to, various conservation zoologists have begun to suggest there's an element missing from our approach to conservation, where it's now accepted by everyone, I think, that genetic diversity is something that needs to be conserved if we're going to conserve animal populations. If animals do have these cultures and they're reliant on them in order to survive in their environment, it follows that we also need to pay attention to whether we're preserving that cultural knowledge as well as all that genetic information. This has been advocated in numerous high-profile papers over the past 5 years, I suppose. And I can see my research fitting in here because since I'm working on methods to determine how important social learning is in freely interacting populations of animals, I think this is something we need to do. We need to figure out where is social learning important, where is cultural knowledge important, what species, what circumstance, so we then know when it's important to conserve that cultural knowledge. And also the methods I'm developing look at the pathways of learning, who learns from whom. For example, often younger individuals learn from older individuals or more dominant individuals. And that kind of knowledge can be important, I think, in deciding how to conserve this cultural knowledge most effectively.
So if you're a student thinking about looking at this area, it strikes me with two things. First of all, it's cutting edge, but also that you call it the missing element to be in with that chance or in with an opportunity of discovering this missing element is
exactly
quite,
yes,
quite exciting.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. My PhD student from who was my PhD student at Leeds University, Sonia Wild, she did her PhD on bottlenose dolphins and was applying a lot of these techniques to look at how bottlenose dolphins learn to survive in their environment. And in probably her most high-impact study, she was looking at how bottlenose dolphins in Shark Bay in Australia, some of them do this technique called sponging, where they will go and they will put a marine sponge on their rostrum, which allows them to go sifting around in the mud, basically on the bottom of the sea, looking for things like flatfish. So they're utilising a novel foraging niche compared to the other bottlenose dolphins. And through her research and other previous research, there's very strong evidence that they learn this from other individuals. The next part of this story is there was a very extreme heat wave in the area, and the bottlenose dolphins, their population suffered very badly, but she found that it was actually the spongers, as we call them, did much better through the marine heat wave than those who were non-spongers. So it seems like their ability for social learning and the fact that they used it to utilize this novel foraging niche enabled them to be more resistant against this extreme climatic event. Such extreme, these climatic events are becoming more common and more extreme as a result of global warming. So that suggests, at least initially, that social learning might be an important factor in which species can ride out the storm, as it were, as social learning and its effects increase.
And what about the research in Cumbrum? Is there an applicable element you can perhaps quote to show how you could use the work that you're doing in this part of the world?
There's not too much yet, because I've only just started here and only just moved here, but I'm looking into opportunities. There's a local proposal to reintroduce black grouse to a local estate, and I have put my name forward, shall we say, add a social learning element to that project and potentially bring some social learning research into that. So we'll see if that gets approved to go ahead.
So in terms of the biggest research achievement today, what would you say it would be?
I would say it is this, as I mentioned before, this network-based diffusion analysis technique. It wasn't me who invented the technique, but I've been one of the people who's done the most to develop the technique, I would say, or one of the people who's applied the technique most to various species. And I think that's had quite a huge impact on the field of social learning, at least, because it's really enabled us to answer questions about social learning in settings and species that we couldn't have done without network-based diffusion analysis and the extensions of it that I've worked on.
What advice would you give to students and prospective students who are interested in this area and looking at this very, very detailed, very different to other aspects of zoology? What would you say to them, and why should they get involved, and why should they look at this as a potential route for study?
My first advice to students is who are already doing a zoology degree, or if they're going into a zoology degree, is make the most of the opportunities your degree and being at university offers you with regards to getting into research in the future. So if you find a particular area of zoology interests you, then use the resources available to you, read around it, research it, get to the cutting edge of that field of research. That will be far more than you need to pass your degree, but take the opportunity to do it if you think that's an area you want to get involved in the future. Because when people are interviewing for a PhD candidate, they might have 100 candidates. So you need to show you've got something more than your degree. You've got a real interest in this area that you're wanting to break into.
And I guess in this area of work, as with your PhD student from Leeds, spotting those dolphins in Australia, who'd have thought, you know? But you know, the world must be full of similar kind of questions that need answering, or queries that people can come up with that a student could look into.
Exactly, yes. Often a PhD student doing these kinds of projects is the best solution, because if it's a project that's not kind of, shall we say, guaranteed to work, then it probably won't get funded to employ a postdoctoral researcher to do it. But often a high risk project is the kind of thing a PhD student would do, because if it doesn't work out, you adapt your research and you do something else. So often PhD students will often end up doing in some ways, the most groundbreaking research.
And just in conclusion, if you were to kind of look back at what you were thinking of doing many years ago into what you're doing now and the future, how do you feel? I mean, do you feel excited? Clearly it does matter, but you know, to what extent do you think it matters, the work that you're doing, the fact that it is looking at behaviour of animals, and which, as you said before, there's still this missing elements, that missing bits of the jigsaw in my mind that you're helping fill it?
I think so. I was excited when I was coming back into academia to see there was so much conversation around how important cultural knowledge and social learning might be for conservation. And I'm excited because I think they're probably right, but I'm also excited for how my own research fits in, because it's relevant for potentially winning over the critics who don't think social learning is very important, since I've been working on the methods to go out and figure out how important social learning is. Who knows, it might prove they're right and social learning isn't all that important, and some species it might prove it is, but that's a question that probably needs answering. And if it proves that cultural knowledge and social learning is important for conservation, then an understanding of how it works, what pathways it follows in groups of animals is important for conserving that cultural knowledge.
For what you said, I mean, clearly it does matter, doesn't it? Because the world is changing, and it's interesting you've been out of academia, coming back in now. I guess one of those reasons you just hinted is because, you know, there is a lot of interest in this area of work, and not just zoology, but in nature, full stop.
I do think animals have always been interesting to people, for especially in the UK. We've always been a nation of animal lovers. This goes back a long way, but perhaps the emphasis has changed, rather than being the natural world being something we take for granted and see as a resource for us to utilize. It's seen more as something that we have to work to protect, and that change in emphasis is something that students of zoology can become involved in.
I've got one last question. You're probably dreading it, because it's the question that I think most people don't enjoy answering, which is this: as we conclude our conversation, can you perhaps choose one word that describes the kind of person you are?
Well, there's two options here. I mean, how I'd like to be viewed as intellectual, but that's more of an aim. It'd be more for the people who work with me to say whether or not I achieve that goal. But perhaps a word that hopefully all the people who work with me would agree on is analytical. I'm very interested in and very focused on trying to quantify the evidence for different hypotheses, and trying to make sure that evidence is quantified precisely and without bias and etc. So that analytical is what I go for.
Good word, and important work. Thank you very much for your time. It's brilliant.
Welcome.
Dr. Will Hoppett, a lecturer in zoology at the University of Cumbria. Thanks for downloading this edition of Research Spotlight at Cumbria. Be sure to subscribe and spread the word.